News. This is KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno. Coming up next, Crack of Dawn with your host, the interesting and erudite Barbara Golden. Tonight she will have Alvin Curran, one of the founders of Musica Electronica Viva, in the studio with premieres of a piece containing the voices of not George Bush, but Annie Sprinkle, in a change from what is written in the folio. And now, Crack of Dawn.
So I noticed someone got bingo.
Yeah. All the way from Florence. This is a time for bingo. It's either bingo or bananas.
Why bananas?
Well, it's the kind of times we're living in. These are banana times.
Like the Banana Republic. And your footsteps, you said they're there 3 a.m. walking alone in Venice?
Yeah, the footsteps are a solo performance that I did recording myself walking through dank alleys in Venice about... Oh, yeah, I don't know, my God, maybe 20 years ago. And, yeah.
Folks, in case you don't turn in yet, but if you tuned in a little late, this is Crack of Dawn. I'm Barb, and Alvin Curran's in the studio. He's recently returned from Australia. And this...
By way of kangaroo.
What's this piece called?
I've given it a title. It's called Monumenti, which means monuments in Italian, and it was originally created for a large installation at the Frankfurt Opera House, the old Opera House, the one that didn't burn down.
Oh, and the foghorns are from Battery Park in New York at right. 5 a.m.
Always welcome to hear those, since our beautiful Golden Gate and Alcatraz horns are always out there playing day and night. It's nice to hear what's happening on the coast.
Nice harmony here.
Yeah.
What's your main home?
Well, it's Rome. I mean, it's around Rome. Right now it's outside of Rome in the country. I've lived there for nearly 30 years. Most of my adult life, really.
That's why you look so relaxed, I think. You have a very good life. Very enviable. I mean, it's kind of the best of both worlds type thing.
Well, there's a lot to be said for the Bay Area, and there's a lot in common that is Italian life and Bay Area life has a lot in common. The only difference is this is the USA and that's Italy. Alas.
Yeah, what about North Beach?
Well, I don't know. I've never been to North Beach, so I...
Really?
I can't...
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. You have to... we'll have to check it out sometime.
Right.
You know,
you take me there.
Trieste and all those cafes are right, very nice. They're, yeah. They would remind you of something. I'm not sure about
well,
what,
yeah,
but
I,
they're...
Yeah.
The atmosphere is extremely different, let's say, than... Yeah. Berkeley or something.
Oh, really?
Like uh-huh. Oh, yeah, Oakland, Berkeley. It's a totally different feel. Yeah. Even, you know, the places that the art venues and stuff you go to in San Francisco, it's very different.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm up to any experience.
I noticed.
Anything that's around, you just gotta find out about it.
Is this male voice, it's still bingo?
It's the bingo. Just the man calling out numbers.
Bingo! I like to say bingo. Was that a cash register or something? Giving the prize?
I don't know what that...
Where was the bingo game? In Florence, did you say?
Yeah, it was in Florence, in a kind of a community, just one of those, like a community house. A neighborhood. And I happened to be rehearsing a theater piece there at the time, and the people in the next room were having this gigantic bingo game. It became a sound, it just crept into the theater piece. I mean, you know, most of my life I've just been out with a tape recorder, just on the streets, anywhere, letting the sounds just come into my music.
What about Australia? Did you tape a lot of
things? Oh, indeed, yeah. Well, you know, I went there to do this big Shiphorn concert in the port of Sydney. And we had about 30 Shiphorns and eight conch shells and three didgeridoos and four percussion.
Well, was everybody on boats?
Yeah, the musicians were all on barges.
On different barges?
On different barges, floating around in front of the opera house. You know, the opera house in Sydney, it's this famous architectural site which looks and acts like a kind of ship itself. It's quite a monument. And I was seated in front of, on the point, which is called Bennelong Point, in front of the opera house, looking out across the bay, and in front of me the various barges with these musicians, well amplified, were moving in sort of figure eight patterns in and around each other, with these didgeridoos and conch shells and ship horns and stuff. It was quite a concert.
what a feeling you must have had.
Yeah, well, Australia is out. I mean, Australia is in another place.
So you were saying the feeling of freedom and of possibility?
Well, it's the farthest place from anywhere that I've ever been. And the Australians know that. They know they're far from
everything.
Everything. And yet they're as close to everything as they want to be.
It's their satellite dish.
Well, not only that, they're plugged into them to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Their life is on this marvelous island continent. And one just has to think, you know, that you're not ever any more than an hour or two from the nearest nothing. I mean, you can get to the outback in no time.
Did you get out there at all?
No, I had no time really.
Uh-huh. But you'll go back.
I'll definitely go back. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, this it was interesting because this. Festival, which was called Sound Culture. I called it the Culture Club, but it was really called the Sound Culture, and its main promoters were, aside from the Australian radio, the ABC, and a place called the Performance Space, and various universities, and in Sydney, it's a kind of a loosely knit group that, called the something of the Pacific Rim. I don't remember what the something is, but anyway, it has to do with Pacific Rim culture. And I've been inspired through this idea to think about a piece for the coming years, which they're asking me to do, possibly in 93, which would unite San Francisco, Tokyo, and Sydney live on the radio. Possibly with didgeridoos, shakuhachis, and American Indians, something like that.
What about Australian, native peoples?
Well, the didgeridoo is the native instrument, and it's right. One of the greatest instruments in the world.
Shakuhachi,
and of course there'll be shiphorns. I can't.
Why shiphorns?
I mean,
they're so beautiful. They are.
Well,
so
shiphorns are like the embodiment of mystery and adventure and distance and myth and dream and faraway places.
They're also so beautiful sounding as well.
Oh, they're amazing instruments. They're among also the very biggest ones which I've had access to on some of my land-based concerts where I've used just ship horns without the ships and had them played by computers. I did one of these in Berlin. I did one of these in along the Danube in Linz on two occasions in the past few years. The ship horns themselves are the most powerful sounding instruments in the world. They're made to be heard for miles. so they're the loudest. They're the loudest man-made instrument.
What are they made of? I mean, is it a machine or what?
I don't know. They're made of. They're made of metal and sweat or something. I don't know what they're made of. I never got into the mechanics.
But are you saying you own some or you?
No, I hired some. There's a company in Germany that lets me use their shipboards. They're in Kiel, which is near Hamburg. Yeah. So I've become a ship horn addict.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess it's better than cocaine. It's less lethal. Seems to be getting you around the world.
Well, it's you know, without them, I just wouldn't be working.
Really?
No.
No. What's the food like?
In Australia? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a mixture of... I can't say that I really had Australian food, although kangaroo meat is available and kangaroo steaks and things like that.
You didn't have that, though, did
no,
you?
No. But I mean, people... It's local fare. Mm-hmm. Kangaroo stew and things like that. But all of the major ethnic restaurants are there in quantity and excellent quality, especially... The Asian countries are extremely well represented because of the proximity.
So close,
they're all there, and then you know, there's just about every kind of food you can imagine. So also some very good, you know, good health food and, you know, good veggie burgers and stuff like that.
Oh, great!
Yeah.
So they're totally tapped into whatever.
Oh yeah.
So what should we listen to?
Oh, whatever you want. I mean, I've got a new piece we can listen to that, which hasn't even been heard.
Yeah, why don't we check that out?
It's a piece which I've
which you did tonight, right?
Oh no, not that one. No, we'll play that later. That's too convulsive to play at this time.
Isn't that the piano piece? Didn't you? I thought you did that.
Oh no. That's a piece which has been made for the Tricia Brown Dance Company.
Is that what we're going to hear?
Yeah, and she's premiered that, and she's premiering that next, actually right in these days in France, and then in a small town, and then bringing it to Paris in December, and then around the world. And it's the title of this piece is One Step Two, and the music is self-explanatory. It's a kind of rondo where the piano music keeps coming back. The same little theme all the time, a little bit modified by electronics each time, and interspersed with some very unusual sounds from my basic vocabulary.
By the way, if you want to phone and talk to Alvin Kern, the number here is area code 510 or 415. They'll both do at this point, 848-4425, and we'll try and figure out how to answer the phone. You know, we're in a new studio here, which is absolutely beautiful and very user-friendly. But I was still more used to the labyrinthine, you know, archaic old studio. So that's 848-4425. And tell us the name of that piece again, Alvin.
It's called One Step Two.
Well, we're on the air with our telephone caller, I think. We better talk about your upcoming concert, because on Monday at Life on the Water, Alvin is doing a concert. So what is it?
Right. Well, it's I really had a, you know, I'm here at Mills College this year, and I was looking for a slot to do this big solo piece of mine, which is rather difficult to produce because it requires a lot of special gear, namely a special kind of piano, which allows me to connect myself through MIDI output to grand piano into a lot of all my electronic system. Anyway, this piece is called Electric Rags. It's the original Electric Rags. And it's being it's going to go on at Life on the Water at 8 p.m. on Monday. And
is this solo?
It's a solo performance. I'll be assisted by Scott Gresham Lancaster, who'll be helping me musically and technically, but it's basically a solo piano piece. And with a special piano, I'm able to command a whole host of electronic boxes and computers and stuff, which create a kind of mirror image of myself, not necessarily imitating what I do, but when they obey and when they're functioning, that's what they're supposed to do. And then I can throw another switch and they have a life of their own, just do whatever they feel like it. And I interact with these machines as if they were real musicians, which in some respects they are. But in any case, it's a music which is based on entirely on my approaching a state of musical amnesia, and as well as
how so.
Well, I try to forget who I am, where I am, and what I might know musically, because since the music is made entirely spontaneously, I mean, I could easily get up there and play things that I know how to play. I mean, that is, I could mm-hmm. I could reproduce sounds and mm-hmm. gestures and kinds of musics that I know. And of course, that will happen in any case. But as I say, I just try to get away from that and lose myself, and create situations of extreme danger, where I'm putting myself on the edge of the abyss all the time. But if it gets too dangerous, I can always jump back in time and regain my senses.
Bingo.
Yeah, bingo.
Did did you find a number for Life in the Water in case?
No, I'm afraid I didn't. But everyone knows where Life on the Water
everybody.
Is. It's Fort Mason.
Yeah, and it's building.
Building B,
I think it's building.
It's the one
B.
in the middle.
And. You could phone KPFA, or you can just phone Life on the Water, or just show up at 8 o'clock on
8
Monday.
8 p.m.
right?
on Monday, yeah.
It's a wonderful setting too,
yeah.
And so that'll be great. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno. This is Crack O'Don. I'm Barb, and special guest is Alvin Curran. Just a few announcements of upcoming performances. There's, as part of the Festival of Indonesia, this is November 24th, the Julia Morgan Theater. I think this is probably one of the most interesting things that just has never come around before, and it's Batak of North Sumatra, its first visit to North America. And it sounds really very powerful. It says their traditional music is remarkably varied, from the hauntingly delicate to the thunderously powerful. And I know the producer of Festival Indonesia, and she's most excited about this. So it's Julia Morgan Theater, November 24th, 8 p.m. For information, 474-3914. So that's a Sunday night at 8. Overreaction is playing at the Marsh on 878 Valencia, Wednesday, November 6th at 8 p.m. That's at the Marsh on Valencia, between 21st and 22nd. Wendy Reed is doing, just producing a water concert at the, it's in the series New Music with Birds, Frogs, and Other Creatures, and it's at the Oakland Museum. So that's Sunday the 24th as well, but that's 3 p.m. Works by Susan Alexander, Charles Armakanian, Chris Bobrowski, Ed Osborne, Mark Trail, and Rick Zappa. That seems like it'll be very, very interesting. Performances by William Winant and others. And lastly, but not least, Move Dance Theater. dance concert Friday, November 15th, Saturday, November 16th. And that's on, where is it? Oh, the Open Arts Circle, 530 East 8th Street in Oakland. And for information, call Move Dance, 465-6678. And Bonnie Sita is the artistic director there, and it should be a good show. Oh, let's see. Here's one more thing. Oh, Miguel Fresconi. Yeah, Monday, November 25th. He's very interesting composer, musician. And keyboardist Robert Marsagni is one of his guests. And that is at the New Performance Gallery, Monday, November 25th. So for information for that, 428-0136, works of Miguel Fresconi. Really recommend that concert. So, Alvin.
Hi.
Hi. What's your idea of a perfect day from the start? You wake up.
A perfect day? Well, there's different kind of perfect days for me. I mean, there's ones in which I make music, and there's ones in which I don't make music.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I think a perfect day would sort of a perfect day for me would combine love making and music making in equal parts, and and gardening.
What do you garden?
Well, I grow my own vegetables when I'm back home.
Yeah, I've heard about your tomatoes. Oh, really?
Yeah, well, they're very good.
What else? What other vegetables?
Well, I grow, you know, all the summer vegetables and winter vegetables as well. I mean, anything from fennel to broccolis to you know, peppers and melons. What's melon sound in English?
Eggplant.
Vegetables like that, cucumbers. Lots of strange, not strange, but unusual salads like like watercress, which are very difficult to grow in arid places.
And you grow
water? Well, I you have to put. They need a lot of water.
I heard that you're a very good cook from Richard Teitelbaum. I think he pits all his friends against each other, so they try to be a better cook than the last guest or something. So therefore, they're in the kitchen all the time.
Yeah, I've been known to satisfy a few palates.
Yeah, you like to party too. I mean, after
indeed, yeah.
But you know, it's good to work hard and play hard, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
My friend thought that you had done a piece with chimes in some city. What was that you thought it was?
Well, I did do a piece with chimes. I did a piece with church bells in Montreal. It was a commission from New Music America in 1990. And there were three commissions. One was given to Hildegard Westerkamp, one was to myself, and one was to a Montreal composer whose name I've forgotten. And I created a piece which was called Call to Prayer, which used the church tower and as a kind of source of sound source, not only for the bells, but as if all the sounds of all the religions of the world emanated from this structure. And started off with a muezzin singing a real call to prayer in Arabic and various Shinto rites and Hebrew rites, African rites, different rites around the world, all blended into this one piece, which was for bells, a large chorus and three percussion players. Oh, and a couple of ram's horns.
But of course.
I have to stay close to home.
Absolutely. tell me about Mev a little bit, because it's so famous. That's Musica Elettronica Viva. And it's so famous because really, wasn't it one of the first electroacoustic improvisational...
Well, according to the books, it was, yes. I think according to us, it certainly was. I mean, we had counterparts. There were three other groups operating at the same time in similar ways.
Who were they?
One was the AMM group, led by Cornelius Cardew in London. And there was MEV, that was us in Rome. And then there was the Sonic Arts Union with Bob Ashley and
David Berman
and Gordon Mummer and Lussier.
Yeah.
And we, although each of us explored different areas, the MEV group and the AMM group in particular really dedicated themselves for several years to spontaneous music making with homemade instruments and very, very primitive electronics. And this is way before... this is even before analog synthesizers.
It was just the very years when the first
Moog synthesizer came out in 1967, which Richard Teitelbaum, incidentally, who we just named, had. He had one of the first Moog... Well, he had the first Moog synthesizer in Europe, which Bob Moog gave him. Or he bought or lent or something.
Whatever.
Anyway. Many more Moog synthesizers were sold. As soon as anyone saw this incredible black box and all of these all those things that came out of it. It was really quite a box.
Great.
So those were the beginnings. The beginnings were part of this mad utopia of pre-68,
mm-hmm.
And it led to even more fruitful and mad anarchy as the years went by. And the group actually committed a kind of self-destruction. Willful suicide by as our music and developed over a period of 5 years, we found the we couldn't keep the public out of it. So
this whole idea
of making collective music finally extended itself completely to
the whole
public. We created a piece called a sound pool, where everyone was invited to come with an instrument or a sound making device. And believe me, in those days, people really came and played, and there was no ego trips. It was really more of a real collective feeling.
It seems to me that it was like another planet.
Yeah, it was definitely another planet. It was too short-lived, but the effects will be felt after we get over Reaganism.
I think once
we get through this cycle, as Anthony Braxton would say.
When? Do you have any prediction when it's going to be over?
I have no prediction, but I hope soon.
Any idea?
There's too much suffering going on. There's not enough enjoyment.
Spontaneity is, yeah.
Well, I mean, real suffering in the social sense. I mean, there's
that too, but
there's times are hard and so on. And almost all utopias have been put on hold. They haven't been canned, they've just been put on hold because it simply isn't, it just isn't part of the 90s.
Sure isn't. That's why I'm hoping, I was asking for a prediction of a year. I wonder if it's going to be the turn of the century or what. But anyway.
Well, we're dealing just with basic survival now.
Just to get back to Mev for a second, The records are so uneven. You'd hear one record, and it would be absolutely impeccable musically, aesthetically.
Yeah.
And then you hear another one, and it was just like real kind of self-indulgent mishmash.
Yeah.
Like what was...
That describes pretty much of what... I mean, there were moments of great... elegance and incredible harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And there was other moments of extraordinary chaos and convulsions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also typical of the times. I mm-hmm. mean, those were the times. They were convulsive and very harmonious at the same time.
That's not a criticism at all, by the way. Well,
no.
You know, just simply that the sculpt
no,
was
no,
so.
No, just we
you know,
we just expressed
everywhere,
what
all
was.
Over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was. I'm sorry. I didn't bring along anything to play. I could actually, had I thought about it, I could have brought a recent recording, which was recorded by MEV. Incidentally, the MEV members, some of you might know, are myself, Alvin Curran, and Frederick Shevsky, keyboards, Richard Teitelbaum, synthesizers, Garrett List on trombone, Steve Lacey on soprano saxophone. That has been the core group for the last 15 years, and we do get to play once or twice a year together still.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was going to say. Of those three groups, man,
well, they
wheel
us on, they wheel us on
yeah,
stage
they
once in a while, you know. But the group, in a recent recording that we made in in Zurich, came up with one of our best offerings, I think, musically that we've ever made.
Oh, really?
It's extraordinary.
Is it
yeah.
a CD?
No, it's kind of supposed to, it might, they were talking uh-huh. to the Hat Hut people
uh-huh.
about it. They threatened to bring it out.
Uh-huh. Well, they seem to sometimes yeah. live up to their threats.
Yeah, they might. They'll probably bring it out.
What's the first music you ever remember hearing?
Oh, my, I don't know. It was either my mother playing stride piano or my father playing some sort of Sunday morning melodies on the trombone.
Oh, they both were musicians?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How?
My mother used to play in silent movies, and my father played, he played in vaudeville.
In Rhode Island?
Yeah. I used to accompany him on Sunday afternoons to these vaudeville shows where they would, you know, they'd have a bunch of shows like magicians and dancers and singers and hypnotists, and then they'd have a movie afterwards. Yeah.
So how old were you when you started playing?
Well, I was 5 when I officially had my first piano lesson.
From your mother?
No, from a local teacher from Odessa in Russia.
But she was living in Rhode Island.
Yeah, she was living in Providence, yeah.
What do you dream about?
What do I dream about? I knew you were going to ask me that.
Well, I told you I was going
to ask
you
dream,
in the car.
Yeah, I know. When I dream, when I can remember my dreams, I've had some extraordinary dreams, mostly about flying. Sometimes flying and falling.
Oh my God!
Well, those are wonderful. I mean,
falling.
Well, I mean,
gently.
Well, hopefully.
Not like the bungee cord person.
No, right? No. And you know the usual. I don't know. I mean, then I've occasionally had dreams of, you know, on rare occasion, I've actually heard music in my dreams. But those are very rare. I sometimes meet dead people in my dreams. And of course, you know, this whole host of erotic dreams that I think everyone experiences. But I only have very, very brief periods where I can recall anything that I've ever dreamt.
Who's the last dead person that you met in your dream?
My father.
When did he die?
My goodness, it must be 7 years ago, 8 years ago.
Oh, so that's pretty recent.
Yeah, recently, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Your mother still play piano?
No, she doesn't.
Does she still have the piano?
She still has the piano.
I hate when they get rid of the piano.
Yeah.
You know,
I've recorded the piano. It's one of the most out of tune pianos that in the whole United States. And I did a whole hour of improvisation on it, and you know, probably someone will bring it out posthumously when I'm gone.
Of course. Is that an oxymoron? posthumously when I'm gone. I think that's an oxymoron.
I think it is.
What do you have some advice for some beginning or young composers?
Yes, I do. I give it every day in my teaching. Forbear. Persevere. And I'm being facetious. I think there's nothing that I can advise if anyone is really going decided to seriously be an artist in the late 20th century. My hat is off to you.
But I think forbear and persevere really is good advice.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, it's all you can do.
Well, you have to have a great deal of courage to do that today, because even though more and more people are doing it, there's careers galore in the art world that had boomed and then crashed in the 70s and 80s, and then a lot of young people I think got the impression from the easy and available kinds of success that we know about in the Western world, are constantly encouraged to take up the role of performing, or whether it be visually or musically or with movement. And it seems to me that some of this encouragement has been really false, because the real roots of artistic creation, which are essentially spiritual ones, are quickly glossed over when you slide into the nearest record company's office and talk to people about making money.
Well, I don't think there are that many composers that are in it for the money. I think they're in artists. I think there's a great number that are just in it because that's what they want to do.
Well, that's also true, but I think there's
kind of the altruistic bunch side of things.
There's
an
altruistic bunch. And
not altruistic. What am I talking about? Is that altruistic?
No, I don't know what.
My mind isn't working.
Well, I know what you mean. The ones who are dedicated only to their work. But I think those dreams are also false, because after all, one has to survive through one's work. That's the first important thing. And one of the curious things in the art instruction and creative instruction in this country is you're practically told that this is impossible.
Well, because in this country, art isn't really revered. The artists aren't really...
Well, it is revered by a small and dedicated amount of people.
But not...
And a growing...
But by the government, the way it is seems to be in Europe.
Well, I don't think we can depend on governments for anything anymore.
Absolutely.
So...
What were you saying, though? Growing number of... Like,
well, there's a growing number of artists who are convinced that their work can be a source of living, of their life, of their economic life as well as their artistic life. So, it seems to me that the more one insists on this, after all, you can't. Live with your music or whatever it is you do in a vacuum, and if you really are serious about what it is that you're doing, you have to become an economic member of the society. It's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that anyone owes us anything, the government or society, but especially in the work that we do, which is somewhat on the edge and somewhat non-commercial and or commercializable. Is that a word?
Well, we get the drift.
So, but even a lot of this work has been proven highly successful. I mean, some of the minimal composers of my own generation have had amazing and worthy success, and experimental artists like Laurie Anderson, for example, who had inherent in her work certain commercial aspects because she used lots of pop elements, tried and is trying to bridge that middle ground between advanced commercial work and experimental music making, as is Robert Ashley, who imagined that he even thought of, you know, music videos long before the music video thing even hit, and is basically inspired by this world of video and TV and popular elements, as well as he is inspired by Gertrude Stein and Joyce and other writers who would appear by and large incomprehensible to the mass audience.
He's my hero. He and Bob Dylan.
Yeah, well, you ought to hear this latest piece of his. The latest two operas are really knockouts.
Which one is that? You mean Now Eleanor's Idea?
Yeah, and El Aficionado.
El Aficionado, yeah. I was sorry that I couldn't be in New York last week and hearing them.
Yeah.
So let's hear some more of your music.
Okay. I'd like to play a 1990 version this is actually a rehearsal that I did for Electric Rags, which I'm performing at Life on the Water on Monday. But it'll give you an idea of what this piece sounds like with my own spontaneous piano playing and the electronics, which are produced in the moment by my own playing. So this is a performance which was done 1990 in the kitchen in New York City.